didn't look much. The dignity was gone out of them. They were good hearts all, then and now, and I did not like to see them so, and I thought the judge had been sent among us for a curse. And yet he proved me wrong. At the time he did. I'm of two minds again now. He was the first to the rim of the cone, for all the size of him, and he stood gazing about like he'd come for the view. Then he sat down, and he began to scale at the rock with his knife. One by one we straggled up, and he sat with his back to that gaping hole, and he was chipping away, and he called upon us to do the same. It was brimstone, a wheel of brimstone all about the rim of the cauldron, bright yellow and shining here and there with the little flakes of silica, but most pure flowers of sulfur. We chipped it loose and chopped it fine with our knives till we had about 2 pounds of it, and then the judge took the wallets and went to a cupped place in the rock and dumped out the charcoal and the niter and stirred them about with his hand and poured the sulfur in them. I didn't know but what we'd be required to bleed into it like Freemasons, but it wasn't so. He worked it up dry with his hands, and all the while the savages down there on the plain drawing nigh to us. And when I turned back, the judge was standing, the great hairless oaf, and he took out his pizzle, and he was pissing into the mixture, pissing with a great vengeance, and one hand aloft, and he cried out for us to do likewise. We were half mad, anyways. All lined up, Delawares and all, every man save Glanton, and he was a study. We hauled forth our members, and at it we went, and the judge on his knees kneading the mass with his naked arms, and the piss was splashing about, and he was crying out to us to piss, man, piss for your very souls, for can't you see the redskins yonder? And laughing the while, and working up this great mass in a foul black dough, a devil's batter by the stink of it, and him not a bloody dark pastryman himself, I don't suppose. And he pulls out his knife, and he commences to trowel it across the south-facing rocks, spreading it out thin with the knife blade, and watching the sun with one eye, and him smeared with blacking and reeking of piss and sulfur, and grinning and wielding the knife with a dexterity that was wondrous, like he did it every day of his life. And when he was done, he sat back and wiped his hands on his chest, and then he watched the savages, and so did we all. They were on the Malpais by then, and they had a tracker who followed us every step on that naked rock, falling back at each blind head and calling out to the others. I don't know what he followed. Scent, perhaps. We could soon hear them talking down there. Then they seen us. Well, God in his glory knows what they thought. They were scattered out across the lava, and one of them pointed, and they all looked up. Thunderstruck, no doubt, to see 11 men perched on the topmost rim of that scalded atoll like misflown birds. They parleyed, and we watched to see would they dispatch any of their number after the horses, but they didn't. Their greed overcame all else, and they started for the base of the cone, scrambling over the lava for to see who would be first. We had, I would suppose, an hour. We watched the savages, and we watched the judge's foul matrix drying on the rocks. And we watched the cloud that was making for the sun. One by one we give up watching the rocks or the savages, either one, for the cloud did look to be dead set for the sun. And it would have took the better part of an hour to have crossed it, and that was the last hour we had. Well, the judge was sitting making entries in his little book, and he saw the cloud same as every other man. And he put down the book and watched it. And we did all. No one spoke. There was none to curse and none to pray. We just watched. And that cloud just cut the corner from the sun and passed on. And there was no shadow fell upon us. And the judge took up his ledger and went on with his entries as before. I watched him. Then I clambered down and tested a patch of the stuff with my hand. There was heat coming off of it. I walked along the rim, and the savages was ascending by every quarter, for there was no route to favor on that bald and gravel slope. I looked for rocks of any size to send down, but there was none there larger than your fist, just fine gravel and plates of scrag. I looked at Glanton, and he was watching the judge, and he seemed to have had his wit stole. Well, the judge closed up his little book and took his leather shirt and spread it out in the little cupped place and called for us to bring this stuff to him. Every knife was out, and we went to scraping it up, and him cautioning us not to strike fire on them flints. And we heaped it up in the shirt, and he commenced to chop and grind it with his knife. "And Captain Glanton," he calls out. "Captain Glanton, would you believe it? Captain Glanton," he says. "Come charge that swivel bore of yours, and let's see what manner of thing we have here." Glanton come up with his rifle, and he scooped his charger full, and he charged both barrels, and patched two balls, and drove them home, and capped the piece, and made to step to the rim. But that was never the judge's way. "Down the maw of that thing," he says. And Glanton never questioned it. He went down the pitch of the inner rim to where lay the terminus of that terrible flue, and he held his piece out over it and pointed it straight down and cocked the hammer and fired. You wouldn't hear a sound like it in a long day's ride. It gave me the fidgets. He fired both barrels, and he looked at us, and he looked at the judge. The judge just waved and went on with his grinding. And then he called us all about to fill our horns and flasks. And we did, one by one, circling past him like communicants. And when all had shared, he filled his own flask, and he got out his pistols and saw to the priming. The foremost of the savages was not more than a furlong on the slope. We were ready to lay into them, but again the judge wouldn't have it. He fired off his pistols down into the cauldron, spacing out the shots. And he fired all 10 chambers and cautioned us back from sight while he reloaded the pieces. All this gunfire had given the savages some pause, no doubt, for they very likely reckoned us to be without powder altogether. And then the judge, he steps up to the rim, and he had with him a good white linen shirt from out of his bag, and he waved it to the redskins, and he called down to them in Spanish. Well, it would have brought tears to your eyes. "All dead save me," he called. "Have mercy on me. Todos muertos, todos," waving the shirt. God, it set them yapping on the slope like dogs. And he turns to us, the judge, with that smile of his, and he says, "Gentlemen," that was all he said. He had the pistol stuck in his belt at the back, and he drew them one in each hand. And he is as either-handed as a spider. He can write with both hands at a time, and I've seen him to do it. And he commenced to kill Indians. We needed no second invitation. God, it was a butchery. At the first fire, we killed a round dozen, and we did not let up. Before the last poor nigger reached the bottom of the slope, there was 58 of them lay slaughtered among the gravels. They just slid down the slope like chaff down a hopper. Some turned this way, some that, and they made a chain about the base of the mountain. We rested our rifle barrels on the brimstone, and we shot 9 more on the lava where they ran. It was a stand, what it was. Wages was laid. The last of them shot was a reckonable part of a mile from the muzzles of the guns, and that on a dead run. It was sharp shooting all around, and not a misfire in the batch with that queer powder. The ex-priest turned and looked at the kid. And that was the judge, first I ever saw him. Aye, he's a thing to study. The kid looked at Tobin. "What's he a judge of?" he said. "What's he a judge of? What's he a judge of?" Tobin glanced off across the fire. "Ah, lad," he said, "hush now. The man'll hear you. His ear's like a fox." Chapter 11. Into the Mountains. Old Ephraim. A Delaware carried off. The search. Another probate. In the gorge. The ruins. Keat seal. The Solaret. Representations and things. The judge tells a story. A mule lost. Mescal pits. Night scene with moon, blossoms, judge. The village. Glanton on the management of animals. The trail out. They rode on into the mountains, and their way took them through high pine forests, wind in the trees, lonely bird calls. The shoeless mules slaloming through the dry grass and pine needles. In the blue coulees on the north slopes, narrow tailings of old snow. They rode up switchbacks through a lonely aspen wood, where the fallen leaves lay like golden disklets in the damp, black trail. The leaves shifted in a million spangles down the pale corridors, and Glanton took one and turned it like a tiny fan by its stem and held it and let it fall, and its perfection wasn't lost on him. They rode through a narrow draw where the leaves were shingled up in ice, and they crossed a high saddle at sunset where wild doves were rocketing down the wind and passing through the gap a few feet off the ground, veering wildly among the ponies and dropping off down into the blue gulf below. They rode on into a dark fir forest, the little Spanish ponies sucking at the thin air. And just at dusk, as Glanton's horse was clambering over a fallen log, a lean, blonde bear rose up out of the swale on the far side, where it had been feeding, and looked down at them with dim pig's eyes. Glanton's horse reared, and Glanton flattened himself along the horse's shoulder and drew his pistol. One of the Delawares was next behind him, and the horse he rode was falling backward, and he was trying to turn it, beating it about the head with his bald fist. And the bear's long muzzle swung toward them in a stunned articulation, amazed beyond reckoning, some foul gobbet dangling from its jaws and its chops dyed red with blood. Glanton fired. The ball struck the bear in the chest, and the bear leaned with a strange moan and seized the Delaware and lifted him from the horse. Glanton fired again into the thick ruff of fur forward of the bear's shoulder as it turned, and the man dangling from the bear's jaws looked down at them, cheek and jowl with the brute and one arm about its neck like some crazed defector in a gesture of defiant camaraderie. All through the woods a bedlam of shouts and the whack of men beating the screaming horses into submission. Glanton cocked the pistol a third time, as the bear swung with the Indian dangling from its mouth like a doll, and passed over him in a sea of honey-colored hair smeared with blood, and a reek of carrion, and the rooty smell of the creature itself. The shot rose and rose, a small core of metal scurrying toward the distant beltways of matter, grinding mutely to the west above them all. Several rifle shots rang out, and the beast loped horribly into the forest with his hostage and was lost among the darkening trees. The Delawares trailed the animal 3 days while the party moved on. The first day they followed blood, and they saw where the thing had rested and where the wounds had stanched. And the next day they followed the drag marks through the duff of a high forest floor. And the day after they followed only the faintest trace across a high stone mesa, and then nothing. They cut for sign until dark, and they slept on the naked flints. And the next day they rose and looked out on all that wild and stony country to the north. The bear had carried off their kinsmen like some fabled storybook beast, and the land had swallowed them up beyond all ransom or reprieve. They caught up their horses and turned back. Nothing moved in that high wilderness save the wind. They did not speak. They were men of another time for all that they bore Christian names, and they had lived all their lives in a wilderness, as had their fathers before them. They'd learnt war by warring. the generations driven from the eastern shore across the continent. From the ashes at Janadenhutten onto the prairies, and across the outlet to the bloodlands of the west. If much in the world were mystery, the limits of that world were not, for it was without measure or bound, and there were contained within it creatures more horrible yet, and men of other colors and beings which no man has looked upon, and yet not alien, none of it, more than were their own hearts alien in them, whatever wilderness contained there, and whatever beasts. They cut the trail of the party early the next day, and by nightfall of the day following they had overtaken them. The lost warrior's horse stood saddled in the caballado, as they had left it, and they took down the bags and divided his estate among them, and that man's name was never said again. In the evening the judge came to the fire and sat with them, and questioned them, and made a map upon the ground, and scrutinized it. Then he rose and trotted out with his boots, and in the morning all rode on as before. Their way led now through dwarf oak and ilex, and over a stony ground where black trees stood footed in the seams on the slopes. They rode through sunlight and high grass, and in the late afternoon they came out upon an escarpment that seemed to rim the known world. Below them in the paling light smoldered the plains of San Augustine. Stretching away to the northeast, the earth, floating off in a long curve, silent under looms of smoke from the underground coal deposits burning there 1,000 years. The horses picked their way along the rim with care, and the riders cast varied glances out upon that ancient and naked land. In the days to come they would ride up through a country where the rocks would cook the flesh from your hand, and where other than rock nothing was. They rode in a narrow enfilade along a trail strewn with the dry round turds of goats, and they rode with their faces averted from the rock wall and the bake oven air which it rebated, the slant black shapes of the mounted men stenciled across the stone with a definition austere and implacable, like shapes capable of violating their covenant with the flesh that authored them, and continuing autonomous across the naked rock without reference to sun or man or God. They rode down from this country through a deep gorge, clattering over the stones, rifts of cool blue shade. In the dry sand of the arroyo floor, old bones and broken shapes of painted pottery, engraven on the rocks above them pictographs of horse and cougar and turtle, and the mounted Spaniards, helmeted and bucklered and contemptuous of stone and silence and time itself. Lodged in faults and crevices 100 feet above them were nests of straw and jetsam from old high waters, and the riders could hear the mutter of thunder in some nameless distance, and they kept watch on the narrow shape of sky overhead for any darkness of impending rain, threading the canyon's close-pressed flanks, the dry white rocks of the dead river floor round and smooth as arcane eggs. That night they camped in the ruins of an older culture, deep in the stone mountains, a small valley with a clear run of water and good grass. Dwellings of mud and stone were walled up beneath an overhanging cliff, and the valley was traced with the work of old acequias. The loose sand in the valley floor was strewn everywhere with pieces of pottery and blackened bits of wood, and it was crossed and recrossed with the tracks of deer and other animals. The judge walked the ruins at dusk, the old rooms still black with wood smoke, old flints and broken pottery among the ashes, and small dry corn cobs. A few rotting wooden ladders yet leaned against the dwelling walls. He roamed through the ruinous kivas, picking up small artifacts, and he sat upon a high wall and sketched in his book until the light failed. The moon rose full over the canyon, and there was stark silence in the little valley. It may be it was their own shadows kept the coyotes from abroad, for there was no sound of them, or wind, or bird in that place. but only the light rill of water running over the sand in the dark below their fires. The judge all day had made small forays among the rocks of the gorge through which they'd passed, and now at the fire he spread part of a wagon sheet on the ground and was sorting out his finds and arranging them before him. In his lap he held the leather ledger book, and he took up each piece, flint or potsherd or tool of bone, and deftly sketched it into the book. He sketched with a practiced ease, and there was no wrinkling of that bold brow or pursing of those oddly childish lips. His fingers traced the impression of old willow wicker on a piece of pottery clay, and he put this into his book with nice shadings, an economy of pencil strokes. He is a draftsman, as he is other things, well sufficient to the task. He looks up from time to time at the fire, or at his companions in arms, or at the night beyond. Lastly, he set before him the footpiece from a suit of armor, hammered out in a shop in Toledo 3 centuries before. A small steel tapadero, frail and shelled with rot. This the judge sketched in profile and in perspective, citing the dimensions in his neat script, making marginal notes. Glanton watched him. When he had done, he took up the little footguard and turned it in his hand and studied it again, and then he crushed it into a ball of foil and pitched it into the fire. He gathered up the other artifacts and cast them also into the fire, and he shook out the wagon sheet and folded it away among his possibles, together with the notebook. Then he sat with his hands cupped in his lap, and he seemed much satisfied with the world, as if his counsel had been sought at its creation. A Tennessean named Webster had been watching him, and he asked the judge what he aimed to do with those notes and sketches. And the judge smiled and said that it was his intention to expunge them from the memory of man. Webster smiled, and the judge laughed. Webster regarded him with one eye asquint, and he said, "Well, you've been a draftsman somewhere, and them pictures is like enough the things themselves. But no man can put all the world in a book. No more than everything drawed in a book is so." "Well said, Marcus," spoke the judge. "But don't draw me," said Webster, "for I don't want in your book." "My book or some other book," said the judge. "What is to be deviates no jot from the book wherein it's writ. How could it? It would be a false book, and a false book is no book at all." "You're a formidable riddler, and I'll not match words with ye. Only save my crusted mug from out your ledger there, for I'd not have it shown about, perhaps, to strangers." The judge smiled. "Whether in my book or not, every man is tabernacled in every other, and he in exchange, and so on in an endless complexity of being and witness to the uttermost edge of the world." "I'll stand for my own witness," said Webster. But by now the others had begun to call to him his conceit. And who would want to see his bloody portrait anyway? And would there be fights break out in the great crowds awaiting its unveiling? And perhaps they could tar and feather the picture, lacking the article itself. Until the judge raised his hand and called for amnesty, and told them that Webster's feelings were of a different kind, and not motivated by vanity at all. And that he'd once drawn an old Wecco's portrait, and unwittingly chained the man to his own likeness. For he couldn't sleep, for fear an enemy might take it and deface it. And so like was the portrait that he would not suffer it creased, nor anything to touch it. And he made a journey across the desert with it, to where he'd heard the judge was to be found, and he begged his counsel as to how he might preserve the thing. And the judge took him deep into the mountains, and they buried the portrait in the floor of a cave, where it lies yet, for aught the judge knew. When he was done telling this, Webster spat and wiped his mouth, and eyed the judge again. "That man," he said, "was no more than an ignorant heathen savage."
"That's so," said the judge.
"It ain't like that with me. Excellent, said the judge, reaching for his portmanteau. You've no objection to a sketch, then?
I'll sit for no portrait, said Webster. But it ain't like you said.
The company fell silent. Someone rose to stoke the fire, and the moon ascended and grew small over the ruined dwellings. And the little stream braided over the sands on the valley floor shone like woven metal. And save for the sound it made, there was no sound other.
What kind of Indians has these here been, Judge?
The judge looked up.
Dead ones, I'd say. What about you, Judge?
Not so dead, said the judge.
They was passable masons, I'd say that. These niggers hereabouts now ain't no kind.
Not so dead, said the judge. Then he told them another story, and it was this story. In the western country of the Alleghenies, some years ago, when it was yet a wilderness, there was a man who kept a harness shop by the side of the federal road. He did so because it was his trade, and yet he did little of it, for there were few travelers in that place. So that he fell into the habit before long of dressing himself as an Indian, and taking up station a few miles above his shop, and waiting there by the roadside to ask whoever should come that way if they would give him money. At this time he had done no person any injury. One day a certain man came by, and the harness maker, in his beads and feathers, stepped from behind his tree and asked this certain man for some coins. He was a young man, and he refused, and having recognized the harness maker for a white man, spoke to him in a way that made the harness maker ashamed, so that he invited the young man to come to his dwelling a few miles distant on the road. This harness maker lived in a bark house he had built, and he kept a wife and two children, all of whom reckoned the old man mad, and were only waiting some chance to escape him and the wild place he'd brought them to. They therefore welcomed the guest, and the woman gave him his supper. But while he ate, the old man again began to try to wheedle money from him, and he said that they were poor, as indeed they were, and the traveler listened to him, and then he took out two coins which, like, the old man had never seen, and the old man took the coins and studied them, and showed them to his son. And the stranger finished his meal and said to the old man that he might have those coins. But ingratitude is more common than you might think, and the harness maker wasn't satisfied, and he began to question whether he ought not perhaps to have another such coin for his wife. The traveler pushed back his plate and turned in his chair and gave the old man a lecture. And in this lecture the old man heard things he had once known but forgotten, and he heard some new things to go with them. The traveler concluded by telling the old man that he was a loss to God and man alike, and would remain so until he took his brother into his heart as he would take himself in, and he had come upon his own person in want in some desert place in the world. Now as he was concluding this speech, there passed on the road a nigger, drawing a funeral hearse for one of his own kind. And it was painted pink, and the nigger was dressed in clothes of every color, like a carnival clown. And the young man pointed out this nigger passing in the road, and he said that even a black nigger... Here the judge paused. He had been looking into the fire, and he raised his head and looked around him. His narration was much in the manner of a recital. He hadn't lost the thread of his tale. He smiled at the listeners about. Said that even a crazy black nigger was not less than a man among men. And then the old man's son stood up and began an oration himself, pointing out at the road and calling for a place to be made for the nigger. He used those words, that a place be made. Of course, by this time the nigger and hearse had passed on from sight. With this, the old man repented all over again, and swore that the boy was right, and the old woman who was seated by the fire was amazed at all she had heard, and when the guest announced that the time had come for his departure, she had tears in her eyes, and the little girl came out from behind the bed and clung to his clothes. The old man offered to walk him out the road so as to see him off on his journey, and to apprise him of which fork in the road to take and which not, for there were scarcely any way signs in that part of the world. As they walked out, they spoke of life in such a wild place, where such people as you saw but one, and never again. And by they came to the fork in the road, and here the traveler told the old man that he had come with him far enough. And he thanked him, and they took their departure, each of the other, and the stranger went on his way. But the harness maker seemed unable to suffer the loss of his company, and he called to him, and went with him again a little way upon the road. And by they came to a place where the road was darkened in a deep wood, and in this place the old man killed the traveler. He killed him with a rock, and he took his clothes, and he took his watch and his money, and he buried him in a shallow grave by the side of the road. Then he went home. On the way he tore his own clothes and bloodied himself with a flint. And he told his wife they had been set upon by robbers, and the young traveler murdered, and him only escaped. She began to cry, and after a while she made him take her to the place. And she took wild primrose, which grew in plenty thereabout, and she put it on the stones. And she came there many times until she was old. The harness maker lived until his son was grown, and never did anyone harm again. As he lay dying, he called the son to him and told him what he had done. And the son said that he forgave him, if it was his to do so. And the old man said that it was his to do so. And then he died. But the boy was not sorry, for he was jealous of the dead man. And before he went away, he visited that place, and cast away the rocks, and dug up the bones, and scattered them in the forest. And then he went away. He went away to the west, and he himself became a killer of men. The old woman was still living at the time, and she knew none of what had passed, and she thought that wild animals had dug the bones and scattered them. Perhaps she didn't find all the bones, but such as she did, she restored to the grave, and she covered them up and piled the stones over them and carried flowers to that place as before. When she was an old woman, she told people that it was her son buried there, and perhaps by that time it was so. Here the judge looked up and smiled. There was a silence, then all began to shout at once with every kind of disclaimer. "He was no harness maker. He was a shoemaker, and he was clear of them charges," called one. And another, "He never lived in no wilderness place. He had a shop dead in the center of Cumberland, Maryland." "They never knew where them bones come from. The old woman was crazy, known to be so." "That was my brother in that casket, and he was a minstrel dancer out of Cincinnati, Ohio, was shot to death over a woman." And other protests, until the judge raised both hands for silence. "Wait now," he said, "for there's a rider to the tale. There was a young bride waiting for that traveler, with whose bones we are acquainted, and she bore a child in her womb that was the traveler's son. Now this son, whose father's existence in this world is historical and speculative, even before the son has entered it, is in a bad way. All his life he carries before him the idol of a perfection to which he can never attain. The father dead has euchred the son out of his patrimony. For it is the death of the father to which the son is entitled, and to which he is heir, more so than his goods. He will not hear of the small, mean ways that tempered the man in life. He will not see him struggling in follies of his own devising. No, the world which he inherits bears him false witness. He is broken before a frozen God, and he will never find his way." "What is true of one man," said the judge, "is true of many. The people who once lived here are called the Anasazi, the old ones. They quit these parts, routed by drought or disease or by wandering bands of marauders, quit these parts ages since, and of them there is no memory. They are rumors and ghosts in this land, and they are much revered. The tools, the art, the building, these things stand in judgment on the latter races. Yet there is nothing for them to grapple with. The old ones are gone like phantoms, and the savages wander these canyons to the sound of an ancient laughter. In their crude huts they crouch in darkness and listen to the fear seeping out of the rock. All progressions from a higher to a lower order are marked by ruins and mystery and a residue of nameless rage. So, here are the dead fathers. Their spirit is entombed in the stone. It lies upon the land with the same weight and the same ubiquity. For whoever makes a shelter of reeds and hides has joined his spirit to the common destiny of creatures, and he will subside back into the primal mud with scarcely a cry. But who builds in stone seeks to alter the structure of the universe. And so it was with these masons, however primitive their works may seem to us. None spoke. The judge sat half naked and sweating, for all the night was cool. At length the ex-priest Tobin looked up.
"It strikes me," he said, "that either son is equal in the way of disadvantage. So what is the way of raising a child?"
"At a young age," said the judge, "they should be put in a pit with wild dogs. They should be set to puzzle out from their proper clues the one of three doors that does not harbor wild lions. They should be made to run naked in the desert until..."
"Hold now," said Tobin. "The question was put in all earnestness."
"And the answer," said the judge. "If God meant to interfere in the degeneracy of mankind, would he not have done so by now? Wolves cull themselves, man. What other creature could? And is the race of man not more predacious yet? The way of the world is to bloom and to flower and die. But in the affairs of men there is no waning, and the noon of his expression signals the onset of night. His spirit is exhausted at the peak of its achievement. His meridian is at once his darkening, and the evening of his day. He loves games. Let him play for stakes. This you see here, these ruins, wondered at by tribes of savages. Do you not think that this will be again? Aye, and again. With other people, with other sons." The judge looked about him. He was sat before the fire naked, save for his breeches, and his hands rested palm down upon his knees. His eyes were empty slots. None among the company harbored any notion as to what this attitude implied, yet so like an icon was he in his sitting that they grew cautious and spoke with circumspection among themselves, as if they would not waken something that had better been left sleeping. The following evening, as they rode up onto the western rim, they lost one of the mules. It went skittering off down the canyon wall with the contents of the panniers exploding soundlessly in the hot, dry air, and it fell through sunlight and through shade, turning in that lonely void until it fell from sight into a sink of cold blue space that absolved it forever of memory in the mind of any living thing that was. Glanton sat his horse and studied the adamantine deep beneath him. A raven had set forth from the cliffs far below to wheel and croak. In the acute light, the sheer stone wall wore strange contours, and the horsemen on that promontory seemed very small, even to themselves. Glanton looked upward briefly, as if there were anything to ascertain in that perfect China sky, and then he chucked up his horse, and they rode on. Crossing the high mesas in the days to follow, they began to come upon burned-out pits in the ground where the Indians had cooked mezcal, and they rode through strange forests of maguey, the aloe or century plant, with immense flowering stalks that rose 40 feet into the desert air.
Each dawn, as they saddled their horses, they watched the pale mountains to the north and to the west for any trace of smoke. There was none. The scouts would be already gone, riding out in the dark before the sun rose, and they wouldn't return until night. Reckoning out the camp in that incoordinate waste by palest starlight, or in blackness absolute, where the company sat among the rocks without fire or bread or camaraderie any more than banded apes. They crouched in silence eating raw meat the Delawares had killed on the plain with arrows, and they slept among the bones. A lobe-shaped moon rose over the black shapes of the mountains, dimming out the eastern stars, and along the nearby ridge the white blooms of flowering yuccas moved in the wind, and in the night bats came from some nether part of the world to stand on leather wings like dark satanic hummingbirds and feed at the mouths of those flowers. Farther along the ridge and slightly elevated on a ledge of sandstone squatted the judge, pale and naked. He raised his hand, and the bats flared in confusion. And then he lowered it and sat as before, and soon they were feeding again. Glanton would not turn back. His calculations concerning the enemy included every duplicity. He spoke of ambushes. Even he, in all his pride, could not have believed that a company of 19 men had evacuated an area of 10,000 square miles of every living human. 2 days later, when the scouts returned in the middle of the afternoon and reported finding the Apache villages abandoned, he would not ride in. They camped on the mesa and made false fires and lay all night with their rifles on that stony heath. In the morning, they caught up the horses and descended into a wild valley strewn with grass huts and the remains of old cook fires. They dismounted and moved among the shelters, frail structures of saplings and weeds stuck into the ground, and bent to at the top to form a rounded hovel over which a few rags of hide or old blankets remained. The grounds were strewn with bones and nappings of flint or quartzite, and they found pieces of jars and old baskets and broken stone mortars and rifts of dried bean pods from the mesquite and a child's straw doll and a primitive one-stringed fiddle that had been crushed and part of a necklace of dried melon seeds. The hovel doors were waist high and faced the east, and few of the shelters were tall enough to be stood in. The last one that Glanton and David Brown entered was defended by a large and vicious dog. Brown drew his belt pistol, but Glanton stopped him. He dropped to one knee and spoke to the animal. It crouched against the rear wall of the hogan and bared its teeth and swung its head from side to side, the ears flattened alongside its skull. "He'll bite you," said Brown. "Get me a piece of jerky." He crouched, talking to the dog. The dog watched him.
"You won't man that son of a bitch," said Brown.
"I can man anything that eats. Get me a piece of jerky."
When Brown came back with the dried meat, the dog was looking about uneasily. When they rode west out of the canyon, it was trotting with a slight limp at the heels of Glanton's horse. They followed an old stone trail up out of the valley and through a high pass, the mules clambering along the ledges like goats. Glanton led his horse and called after the others, and yet darkness overtook them, and they were benighted in that place, strung out along a fault in the wall of the gorge. He led them, cursing upward through the profoundest dark, but the way grew so narrow and the footing so treacherous they were obliged to halt. The Delawares came back afoot, having left their horses at the top of the pass, and Glanton threatened to shoot them all were they attacked in that place. They passed the night, each man at the feet of his horse where it stood in the trail, between a sheer rise and a sheer fall. Glanton sat at the head of the column with his guns laid out before him. He watched the dog. In the morning they rose and went on, picking up the other scouts and their horses at the top of the pass and sending them on again. They rode through the mountains all that day, and if Glanton slept, none saw him do so.
The Delawares had reckoned the village empty 10 days, and the Helenos had decamped in small bands by every egress. There was no trail to follow. The company rode on through the mountains single file. The scouts were gone for 2 days. On the third day, they rode into camp with their horses all but ruined. That morning, they'd seen fires atop a thin blue mesa 50 miles to the south. Chapter 12. Crossing the border. Storms. Ice and lightning. The slain Argonauts. The Azimuth. Rendezvous. Councils of war. Slaughter of the Helenos. Death of Juan Miguel. The dead in the lake. The chief. An Apache child. On the desert. Night fires. El Virote. A surgery. The judge takes a scalp. Un hacendado. Gallego. Ciudad de Chihuahua. For the next 2 weeks, they would ride by night. They would make no fire. They had struck the shoes from their horses and filled the nail holes in with clay. And those who still had tobacco used their pouches to spit in. And they slept in caves and on bare stone. They rode their horses through the tracks of their dismounting, and they buried their stool like cats, and they barely spoke at all. Crossing those barren gravel reefs in the night, they seemed remote and without substance, like a patrol condemned to ride out some ancient curse. A thing surmised from the blackness by the creak of leather and the chink of metal. They cut the throats of the pack animals and jerked and divided the meat, and they traveled under the cape of the wild mountains upon a broad soda plain with dry thunder to the south and rumors of light. Under a gibbous moon, horse and rider spancelled to their shadows on the snow-blue ground, and in each flare of lightning as the storm advanced, those self-same forms rearing with a terrible redundancy behind them, like some third aspect of their presence hammered out black and wild upon the naked grounds. They rode on. They rode like men invested with a purpose whose origins were antecedent to them, like blood legatees of an order both imperative and remote. For although each man among them was discreet unto himself, conjoined they made a thing that had not been before, and in that communal soul were wastes hardly reckonable, more than those whited regions on old maps where monsters do live, and where there is nothing other of the known world save conjectural winds. They crossed the Del Norte, and rode south into a land more hostile yet. All day they crouched like owls under the niggard acacia shade, and peered out upon that cooking world. Dust devils stood on the horizon like the smoke of distant fires, but of living thing there was none. They eyed the sun in its circus, and at dusk they rode out upon the cooling plain, where the western sky was the color of blood. At a desert well they dismounted and drank jaw to jaw with their horses, and remounted and rode on. The little desert wolves yapped in the dark, and Glanton's dog trotted beneath the horse's belly, its footfalls stitched precisely among the hooves. That night they were visited with a plague of hail out of a faultless sky, and the horses shied and moaned, and the men dismounted and sat upon the ground with their saddles over their heads while the hail leaped in the sand like small loosened eggs concocted alchemically out of the desert darkness. When they resaddled and rode on, they went for miles through cobbled ice while a polar moon rose like a blind cat's eye up over the rim of the world. In the night they passed the lights of a village on the plain, but they did not alter from their course. Toward the morning, they saw fires on the horizon. Glanton sent the Delawares. Already the dawn star burned pale in the east. When they returned, they squatted with Glanton and the judge and the Brown brothers, and spoke and gestured, and then all remounted and all rode on. 5 wagons smoldered on the desert floor, and the riders dismounted and moved among the bodies of the dead Argonauts in silence, those rite pilgrims nameless among the stones with their terrible wounds, the viscera spilled from their sides, and the naked torsos bristling with arrow shafts. Some by their beards were men, but yet wore strange menstrual wounds between their legs, and no man's parts, for these had been cut away and hung, dark and strange, from out their grinning mouths. In their wigs of dried blood they lay gazing up with ape's eyes at brother's sun, now rising in the east. The wagons were no more than embers, armatured with the blackened shapes of hoop iron and tires, the red-hot axles quaking deep within the coals. The riders squatted at the fires and boiled water and drank coffee and roasted meat and lay down to sleep among the dead. When the company set forth in the evening, they continued south as before. The tracks of the murderers bore on to the west, but they were white men who preyed on travelers in that wilderness and disguised their work to be that of the savages. Notions of chance and fate are the preoccupation of men engaged in rash undertakings. The trail of the Argonauts terminated in ashes, as told, and in the convergence of such vectors in such a waste, wherein the hearts and enterprise of one small nation have been swallowed up and carried off by another, the ex-priest asked if some might not see the hand of a cynical god conducting with what austerity and what mock surprise so lethal a congruence. The posting of witnesses by a third and other path altogether might also be called in evidence as appearing to beggar chance. Yet the judge, who had put his horse forward until he was abreast of the speculants, said that in this was expressed the very nature of the witness, and that his proximity was no third thing but rather the prime, for what could be said to occur unobserved. The Delawares went on ahead in the dusk, and the Mexican, John McGill, led the column, dropping from time to time from his horse to lie flat on his belly and skylight the outriders on the desert before them, and then remount again without halting his pony or the company which followed. They moved like migrants under a drifting star, and their track across the land reflected in its faint architecture the movements of the earth itself. To the west the cloud banks stood above the mountains like the dark warp of the very firmament, and the star-sprent reaches of the galaxies hung in a vast aura above the riders' heads. 2 mornings later the Delawares returned from their dawn reconnaissance and reported the Jalenos camped along the shore of a shallow lake less than 4 hours to the south. They had with them their women and children, and they were many. Glanton, when he rose from this council, walked out on the desert alone and stood for a long time looking out upon the darkness down country. They saw to their arms, drawing the charges from their pieces and reloading them. They spoke in low voices among themselves, although the desert round lay like a great barren plate gently quaking in the heat. In the afternoon a detachment led the horses out to water and led them back again. And with dark, Glanton and his lieutenants followed the Delawares out to scout the enemy's position. They'd driven a stick into the ground on a rise north of the camp, and when the angle of the dipper had swung about to this inclination, Toadvine and the Van Diemen Lander set the company in motion, and they rode forth south after the others, trammeled to cords of rawest destiny. They reached the north end of the lake in the cool hours before dawn, and turned along the shore. The water was very black, and along the beach there lay a rack of foam, and they could hear ducks talking far out on the lake. The embers of the encampment's fires lay below them in a gentle curve, like the lights of a distant port. Before them on that lonely strand a solitary rider sat his horse. It was one of the Delawares, and he turned his horse without speaking, and they followed him up through the brush onto the desert. The party was crouched in a stand of willow a half mile from the fires of the enemy. They had muffled the heads of the horses with blankets, and the hooded beasts stood rigid and ceremonial behind them. The new riders dismounted and bound their own horses, and they sat upon the ground while Glanton addressed them.
"We got an hour, maybe more. When we ride in, it's every man to his own. Don't leave a dog alive if you can help it."
"How many is there, John?"
"Did you learn to whisper in a sawmill?"
"There's enough to go around," said the judge.
"Don't waste powder and ball on anything that can't shoot back. If we don't kill every nigger here, we need to be whipped and sent home."
This was the extent of their counsel. The hour that followed was a long hour. They led the blindfolded horses down and stood looking out over the encampment, but they were watching the horizon to the east. A bird called. Glanton turned to his horse and unhooded it like a falconer at morning. A wind had risen, and the horse lifted its head and sniffed the air. The other men followed. The blankets lay where they had fallen. They mounted, pistols in hand, saps of rawhide and river rock looped about their wrists like the implements of some primitive equestrian game. Glanton looked back at them and then nudged forth his horse. As they trotted out onto the white salt shore, an old man rose from the bushes where he had been squatting and turned to face them. The dogs that had been waiting on to contest his stool bolted, yapping. Ducks began to rise by ones and pairs out on the lake. Someone clubbed the old man down, and the riders put rowels to their mounts and lined out for the camp behind the dogs with their clubs whirling and the dogs howling in a tableau of some hellish hunt, the partisans 19 in number bearing down upon the encampment where there lay sleeping upward of 1,000 souls. Glanton rode his horse completely through the first wickiup, trampling the occupants underfoot. Figures were scrambling out of the low doorways. The raiders went through the village at full gallop and turned and came back. A warrior stepped into their path and leveled a lance, and Glanton shot him dead. Three others ran, and he shot the first two with shots so closely executed that they fell together, and the third one seemed to be coming apart as he ran, hit by half a dozen pistol balls. Within that first minute, the slaughter had become general. Women were screaming, and naked children, and one old man tottered forth waving a pair of white pantaloons. The horsemen moved among them and slew them with clubs or knives. 100 tethered dogs were howling, and others were racing crazed among the huts, ripping at one another and at the tied dogs. Nor would this bedlam and clamor cease or diminish from the first moment the riders entered the village. Already a number of the huts were afire, and a whole enfilade of refugees had begun streaming north along the shore, wailing crazily, with the riders among them like herdsmen clubbing down the laggards first. When Glanton and his chiefs swung back through the village, people were running out under the horses' hooves, and the horses were plunging, and some of the men were moving on foot among the huts with torches and dragging the victims out, slathered and dripping with blood, hacking at the dying and decapitating those who knelt for mercy. There were in the camp a number of Mexican slaves, and these ran forth calling out in Spanish and were brained or shot. And one of the Delawares emerged from the smoke with a naked infant dangling in each hand and squatted at a ring of midden stones and swung them by the heels each in turn and bashed their heads against the stones, so that the brains burst forth through the fontanelle in a bloody spew, and humans on fire came shrieking forth like berserkers, and the riders hacked them down with their enormous knives, and a young woman ran up and embraced the bloodied forefeet of Glanton's war horse. By now a small band of warriors had mounted themselves out of the scattered remuda, and they advanced upon the village and rattled a drove of arrows among the burning huts. Glanton drew his rifle from its scabbard and shot the two lead horses, and resheathed the rifle and drew his pistol and began to fire between the actual ears of his horse. The mounted Indians floundered among the down and kicking horses, and they milled and circled and were shot down one by one until the dozen survivors among them turned and fled up the lake past the groaning column of refugees and disappeared in a drifting wake of soda ash. Glanton turned his horse. The dead lay awash in the shallows like the victims of some disaster at sea, and they were strewn along the salt foreshore and